13 is a brand founded for the creators, the innovators, and the motivators, for the people who get up every single day and strive to be better and leave a positive mark on this world. 13 is a fantastic clothing company, and the people that are behind it are passionate, creative, and some of the nicest people I have ever met. All of their stuff looks great, it's comfy, all the designs are so super cool. 13 has some of my favorite t-shirts and seriously my favorite pair of sweatpants I have ever worn. 13 has been a longtime sponsor and supporter of the CoreyCast, and they wanted to extend their love to you, the listener. So when you check out their website at thur13en.com, fill your cart with some cool hats, hoodies, sweatpants. Just make sure you use the code word CoreyCast at checkout, and you're going to save yourself a little bit of money. thur13en.com. Make sure you tell them Corey sent you.
My guest today is my new friend, Mike Saltzman. He is the owner of Voltage, a video game store that is in downtown Syracuse. But I connected with him at one of the retro game cons at the On Center. And there he was working for his other company called Viridian Dice. He sells and ships all these really cool D&D dice, and he even designs his own. We kind of talk a little bit about what his process is like for designing the art that's on some of the dice. And it's really cool. It's interesting to see how someone has built a business around selling dice. It's really cool. And he's a really super talented guy. Not only is he able to run a really well-oiled business, especially selling video games in the year 2024, where essentially everything is going digital, but he's also able to run a second company, Viridian Dice, very successfully. He makes a lot of cool stuff, and he is a super talented artist, especially when it comes to all of those cool dice. I'll show you some pictures during the podcast. You'll see just how amazing his work is. You can check him out at Voltage or also Viridian Dice. Very easy to find the dice that he's designed and his website. Below in the show description, I'll put all the links to his website so you can go check out Mike and show him some love. If you are listening to this episode on Spotify, do me a favor, hit that follow button. It's totally free to do, and it helps this podcast grow to a whole new audience. So without further ado, here is my friend Mike Saltzman. So why don't you introduce yourself? We'll start that way.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Mike. I almost feel like this should be at the camera, but I won't.
Know, right?
I'll do it. So my name is Mike Saltzman. I started or own Voltage Video Games downtown, and I also am the CEO / owner of Viridian Dice, which sells dice online. So I have a retail brick and mortar shop downtown, and then the online component
Is the dice,
yeah.
That's cool.
And that's really where I spend most of my time these days. I'm a business owner, entrepreneur type, but then I also do a lot of our design, graphic design, and some other stuff too.
Wow, that is cool. And it's funny, it's because I got introduced to you because we met at a retro game con, and I was talking to you briefly about the dice that you create, and my friend Mike, I saw these cheese dice that I was absolutely, yep. I was dying. And I bought those as a birthday present for him.
So the funny thing about those cheese dice, right? There's a few funny things about them. The first funny thing is that originally some like artist person made like a one-off set of cheese dice and put them online. They didn't watermark their photos at all. So every like scammer out there. I think a lot of them are based in China and East Asia, but like all these scammers like took those photos and like pretended to sell those dice and then just sent you like garbage dice. Yeah, it's part
what?
Of they have this whole big bait and switch scam that's like it's all products. So people might know it because like, oh, I ordered this thing and they sent me a much crappier version and then they argued with me about the refund and whatever. But in any event, they became so popular. And this is kind of a weird thing. So an artist creates a thing. The scammers steal it, put it up all over the place. And then legitimate manufacturers see how popular those scam ads are.
Oh, my God.
And then they legitimately make a product that is similar.
Wow.
So one of our partners made those cheese dice.
Wow.
But they made them in like a red. So they have like little. So for anyone who doesn't know what the hell these cheese dice are, maybe you'll throw an image up.
I should throw a picture. We'll throw a picture up.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. So you'll see that they have like a Swiss cheese, like whole nature to them. Like they have like little whole cutouts, right? But the Chinese company that we work with, when they made these, they made them like red orange, like kind of like
that's not cheese color.
Yeah. Maybe a little more orange than this, but yeah, like neon colored almost. And yeah, that's not cheese color. And that's what we said too. Yeah. We're like, this is not an idea. Well, it's not Swiss cheese color. So when you think Swiss cheese, you think of like this like nice light kind of creamy tan white color. And so that's what we said too. And we got some of theirs and we're like, they're good. They just need to be the right color. So we custom ordered them in a different color. And the nice thing about when you custom order is like they won't make that same colorway for any other like of their manufacturing partners.
Oh, so you lock that color in.
We lock that color in. And that's what happens when you buy a lot of it and like they agree to make that color for you.
Interesting.
And and our color has done really well because it's like actually like a pretty good cheese color. It's not perfect. It's maybe a little still too orange. But we thought about it and we're like, why the hell would they do this like bad color? And then it occurred to us, they're based in China. They don't eat a lot of cheese there.
Oh, okay.
So what they probably did was they Googled cheese, and what they saw was cheddar cheese.
Yeah, right.
And then they were like, perfect, let's do it that color.
Let's and turn the dial up.
That's
so funny. So now you have that color locked in for nobody else.
We do from that manufacturing partner, which has been really great because we sell them on all over the place on Amazon and stuff too.
We're
the only ones with like a good cheese color.
That's amazing.
And what's one of our competitors, they have the kind of bad cheese color. So they just manipulate their photos to look a little more good cheese color.
Oh, no.
And so they're like close to ours and they're like, if only like people knew that like ours were legitimately that color. And theirs will come in and be like more red orange.
That's a cool. So you like design these dice essentially, right?
So yes and no, right? So we both retail a lot of dice. So there's dice that are just like off the shelf, like one of our Chinese partners, one of our other partners, there's some in Germany and some in Poland. They make a whole catalog's worth of products and they make new products all the time. And we select the ones that we think will sell well and we bring them in.
Interesting.
But then the other part that we do is that we customize colors, which is kind of like light design. And then we do full on like some of the products I brought here. We do full on like design as well.
Right.
So we have a huge catalog.
I'll throw up another picture.
These are here. Yep. We have generator dice. So we have like a treasure loot generation dice, which
I think is actually as one of what you brought here.
Yeah.
And like gems on it, scrolls, magic items.
Yeah, and to give people an idea, like these are so that if you're playing like Dungeons and Dragons or some similar kind of tabletop role-playing game and you want to randomly generate different things, these dice are perfect because they let you randomly generate a treasure that the heroes find or a monster that the heroes run into. So it allows you to like kind of improvise dungeons and things like that and parts of the game.
Oh, and even this was the hit dice too, I thought was cool. It tells you like where it...
That one's monster.
Oh, no, this one's monster. Was a hit one, right?
That's
like foot and limb.
That one is actually designed by one of our production partners out of Poland, the same guys who manufacture these for us. And yeah, that one they already had. Could I design one and then like cut out their kind of fees and stuff? I could. There's other things I can design in the meantime.
That's cool.
So
like these dice, when you sit down, how are you designing them? Are you drawing them on paper? Is it on a computer?
The first one I did, I actually did start on paper and then move it to digital. I scanned it and kind of moved it to Adobe Illustrator. But after that, I was like, well, this is like I am redesigning the wheel here. like there are high end tablets and stuff I can do to actually draw it digitally first.
Oh yeah, there's so many good drawing tablets out there.
There are, yeah. And so I just didn't want to make the investment in getting one that was good. I had one that was kind of like okay, and I used it pretty often, mm-hmm. but it had like lag and it wasn't great. So finally, after I did my first one, I was like, all right, it's time just to like
bite the bullet. What was the first one you did?
It was a dungeon one, and it was pretty uninspired because I was basically taking a design that already existed and kind of redrawing it with my own drawings and stuff.
Oh, cool.
Which I don't love that. Just like
a refresh?
A refresh, yeah. It's not very different. It is my drawings, but it has like it's really like I was trying to make my version of their die. And you might go, well, why did you do that? That doesn't sound very original. And I agree with you. And the thing is, we thought that company that was making those had discontinued the die and weren't making it anymore. So I was like, I just want like a version that has my art,
right?
That so we can continue selling this die that we think
like. And it was a dungeon dice, right?
It like shows you like a rooms that you might run into and
stuff. That's cool.
It is cool. And I feel bad because about a month after ours came out, they put theirs back onto their website.
Oh, on the shelf. No.
And I was like, no, it's fine, except I felt bad. I'm like, if I had known you guys were going to keep stocking it, I wouldn't have made one.
Right. Did you like pivot to something else? So you probably dropped that and pivoted to a different dice?
No, we sell them because like they don't own like that. They don't own like randomly generating dungeons.
Right.
It feels a little cheap because it's so similar, but they're also a major company that's had this design for 20 years, et cetera. Oh, I'm not worried that we're like, they just came out with it last year and I ripped them off.
Right.
But I have redoubled my effort to any of the new ones I make. Like the designs have to be like very different. Cool. Like they have like that's a great treasure one too, and I have mine, right? Except theirs is only 8-sided or maybe theirs is 12-sided, but my designs are so radically different. And also I have sides that
they're very
didn't have.
Detailed. Like these thank designs you. On there are really detailed.
Oh man, they take me forever.
Really?
Forever. Because I'm a perfectionist. I want it to be really good. It's 12 different designs, and I'm working on one right now that's 20-sided, and oh my God.
That's 20-sided.
20 designs.
20 designs, and what is the, like, what does, is the dice, is it going to be a magic item dice?
How long until you put this out? I mean, I don't
know. Oh, is it a secret?
Yeah.
It could be a secret. All right, you don't have to give me your
spoiler. Well, how long until this goes out?
So we're recording. Here,
because we're going to publish something at some point. So if I think it's even.
Like, so it would be April 5th or 12th.
April 5th or 12th. Oh, yeah, that's so fine. That's like month. A month. Yeah. Oh, if I'm not done by then that's my fault.
No.
I'm working on a room generator. So like, it sounds kind of similar to the dungeon one. So the dungeon one is like, hey, do you run into like a split in the hallway or like a room with four doors or something? This one decides what's in that room. Right. So you come into a room that's four doors from the other die, right? This
here's one tells you. Slime.
No. Not, that's like more like monster.
Oh, okay.
But by my room, I mean like, hey, is this room a forge? Is it a lab? Is it like quarters? Is it like a dungeon? Like a prison? Like what is in what is the purpose of the room?
That is cool. What a cool idea. Do you usually play D&D like that?
I
like all randomly by dice.
I don't, but I should.
Yeah, I do you play D&D regularly?
I do play D&D regularly.
Nice. Yeah, are you guys playing like a homebrewed or something from the Red Adventures?
Right now, so I've been with the same game group for 7 years, something
really?
Like that. Yeah, it's been a while. We don't play quite as much as I would like. We end up skipping a lot of weeks and stuff. But
adult schedules.
Exactly. Yep. But we have played together for a really long time. We have a pretty good core group. We lost a member like maybe 2 years ago now. He moved abroad. I'm really sad about it. Syracuse University laid him off.
Jerks.
Yeah. And so right now we're playing a couple homebrew games.
Nice.
Run by my friend Sean, and he's been great. I was DMing for a little bit. my brain is too scattered these days to be DMing.
With DMing, I feel like you just got to do a lot of prep work before. Maybe not a lot. I guess it depends on what you're trying to accomplish.
I mean,
unless you have these dice.
Yeah, there you go.
Unless you have these dice.
Buy these dice. Viridiandice.com. Yeah, exactly. That would be a good, like, I think these work especially great for what I would call are you familiar with the term one shot?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. So for the audience that may or may not know, a one shot is like a one night adventure. So it's not like an ongoing campaign.
Everybody quick, pick your character. So you're going to roll. I don't know. Let's find out. Looks like I'm playing a rogue.
Okay. Well, that didn't say a rogue.
That was a rogue. I was role playing, dude.
You were. You did well. So I think these would be great for doing like a totally improvised dungeon for a one night.
That'd be kind of fun to have a dungeon. And then I feel like it would be fun to be the DM because you got to figure out how you're going to thread a story through all these random different things, right?
And I feel like, so that's part of my design philosophy on these, right? Is that I try to keep them broad so that any DM could like, so for instance, let's go with that room generator I'm talking about where it's got like lab and forge and what are some of the other ones? Like a beast hold where you might hold beasts and or a crypt and things like that, right? So I tried to keep them broad enough that, hey, if anyone rolls crypt, they have like a general sense of what that could be, but it could also go in different directions. Is it the crypt with nothing in it? Is it a crypt that like looks like it was abandoned, or like there what is there like a royalty in that crypt, or is it just like average soldiers of a group or something like that? So you could go a lot of different ways. I also on the art itself, I include, for instance, in the crypt, I include like there's like a little skeleton warrior that was like. That looked like they died like defending the crypt. So then like that's an interesting dynamic. And I put like cobwebs so that a DM could see that crypt and go, you know what? Most crypts are gonna have like skeletons and like those undead monsters. But I see that spider web there and it gives me an idea. What if there's a bunch of spiders that like monstrous spiders that have now like
it gives you a really cool like jumping point. It's like it gives the DM a nice spot to be like, all right, perfect crypt. Now let's generate the ideas. It gives them like a place to go to.
I wanted the art itself to be evocative, broad, so that any DM could take it and it wasn't too specific where they'd be like, I don't know what to do with that. But also a couple clues in the art to kind of push somebody in a couple different possible ways. Yeah.
So when you design the art, then how do you get it onto the dice? Do you find a manufacturer who then prints it?
So
I would imagine you'd want to do a test print too to make sure like it looks good on the dice.
Good questions. So we on these ones specifically, these generators, and we've done a few other things too that don't follow this path. But with these generators, they're so high detailed that we've gone with a production partner in Poland called Q Workshop. And they do high quality engraving.
Yeah.
They're very high end.
Yeah. These dice, they look so nice. They look very sharp. Yeah.
You couldn't achieve that quality easily going through China. Now, are there Chinese manufacturers who could do it? Absolutely. But most of the dice retailers dice manufacturers just don't work in that high of a quality.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we went with Poland for these ones specifically. As far as like, hey, samples, typically we do sample rounds on stuff. Like we're working on video game themed one right now. And we already did one
video
round.
Video game theme.
Yep.
That's cool.
We've done one round of sampling. We actually did the Retro Game Con dice, which were like these purple glittery translucent dice, which were great. And we're working on another round of them for this year's Retro Game Con.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. I don't know if I can actually talk about it, but they're going to be cool.
Fine.
They're going to be green.
Yeah.
It's going to be great.
Nice. That's cool. It's really exciting. You don't meet people who like design dice or put things together. So it's really cool that you did this. What like triggered you wanting to start this business?
So I fell into it, right? So I had the video game store already, all right? So I'm kind of in a tangential, adjacent kind of industry, right? And then I got 3D printers, right? Or I got a 3D printer, right? And then I was watching Critical Role, which is a very famous kind of D&D.
So fun.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So a podcast. Or, yeah, a stream podcast. Yeah, okay. And they had these condition rings that I saw, which I recognized as being 3D printed. I'd seen those rings before, and I had made some of them before. This guy who I now know, named Luke in Canada, he put his designs on Thingiverse, which is like a repository for 3D designs that you can like download and print yourself.
Oh, that's cool. Just like a website that holds all of them?
Right. Nice. It's like a Google,
Google image search, but for models.
Yeah, nice. Exactly. And so I saw them on Critical Role, and it gave me the idea that like, oh, well, he should really sell these, because like I'm sure lots of people who watch Critical Role would want to buy them. And I know they're very useful. So it's like, I approached him because his listing was like non-commercial, and I said like, hey, do you sell commercial licenses? And he's like, sure, just give me like a royalty. And so I put them up on like Etsy, and they start selling like crazy.
Wow.
Like it went from being like, hey, this is a little thing I do. I keep this printer running, to like, hey, I need 2 printers. Hey, I need 4 printers.
Oh my God.
Hey, I need 8 printers.
Dude,
hey,
what?
I can't keep up. I had at the height like 30 something printers.
What? Dude.
Yeah. Oh man. So I was doing this out of my house too. And like, I had to get like new breaker boxes, because like I was running out the power.
Yeah.
I was finding out these like very weird niche cases with 3D printers, where if you run too many in a room, the room gets too hot, and then the material that you use
doesn't
hold up well. So I was getting these like weird failures that nobody knew about, because like most people don't run
30 machines in a room.
In a couple of rooms, but yeah. I became an expert in 3D printers. That is for sure.
Just making these condition rings that are just like paralyzed, knocked down, prone.
Yeah,
whatever.
But like this, my perfectionism kicked in, and I wanted our stuff to be really high quality and really good, but also be of a really good price. I described myself the other day as like an everyday value kind of business owner, where I always want to have the best price, and I'll make it up in volume, where I'll sell twice as many as the next guy, and everyone will love us because our prices are so good and stuff. So I came into it with that mentality. So like, I was very perfectionist about the prints. I was very aggressive about the pricing, and yeah, we moved a ton of them. And while moving them, my foot's falling asleep. While moving them, right, we had a competitor. We had a few competitors, but one competitor specifically was using our models. And Luke, he started as just the guy I was licensing from and became my friend and partner, right? He approached them and was like, no, you can't sell these without a
commercial
license.
Right.
And I'll offer you a license. And they said, no, we made these. And we went, or he went, and I also went, no, you what? No.
Right.
You didn't make 70 identical models a month after I put these up on Thingiverse.
Right.
That's absurd and stupid, and you'd have to think we're idiots to actually believe that. So you're just lying. You might as well just not respond, because you're just lying, right? And so this seller did that, right? And so because they were doing that, we were looking at their page and like, well, like what is this seller? Who are they? Like, they're based out of Ireland. And the other things they were listing were dice, right? And I was looking at their dice, and I was like,
oh, tell me they didn't take your dice.
No.
Oh, okay.
We weren't selling dice.
Oh, okay.
We were just a 3D print shop.
Oh, right.
But I saw their dice, and you know, my background in retail and video game sales made me go, well, there's no way these guys are making all these dice in their shop, right?
Right.
So they're sourcing them from somewhere. Boy, and their prices on condition rings were like higher than ours by a good degree. So I'm wondering like, huh, some of their listings were like bestsellers on Etsy and stuff. And I'm wondering like, huh, I wonder if they're doing the same like price jacking on all this other stuff too. And like, they can't possibly make all these dice in-house. It would be ridiculous. And all I see is like them with like woodworking things, because they claim to be a woodworker, right? But they're also 3D printing stuff, because they have a 3D printer, I guess. And I looked around a little through the same kind of channels that I do for my video game store. And up there's the same dice that they sell. Oh, they sell them for $18, and they buy them for, what's the wholesale price?
50 cents.
$3. And I'm looking at that, and I'm like, if I can buy these for $3, then I can sell them all day for 10.
Right.
And you might go, well, that's times three. Well, actually, like, factor shipping and factor costs of storage and employees and all that kind of stuff, right? So it is roughly doubling your money, though. Let's say the final, like, cost of goods sold is, like, $5. Well, then you could sell them for 10.
Right.
50% margin is a totally reasonable margin in most retail businesses.
Yeah.
It can range, but, like, 50%.
50% is really good.
Well, really good for, for you here, maybe with...
Well, I used to work in retail. I was I used to work in at PetSmart, and that goal margin, I mean, that was like 10, 15 years ago, was not near 50.
Really?
Yeah.
I would think it would be.
It probably depends on the store. I bet you a furniture store is probably has higher margin.
I would think it would be lower margin. I think the higher the value of the item, typically the lower the margin.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
It can really vary. Like Best Buy, like on a lot of their like laptops, they might make like $5 or maybe make nothing. But then
it's the accessories, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it depends on the company a little, but like I would say if there was a range in retail margins, it would probably be something like at the high end, like 80%. Like for like accessories and things like that, right? And then on the low end, when you get into like, I don't know, like a jet ski, you might only make 10%.
Right.
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 So, but 10% on a $3,000, I don't know what jet skis cost, $10,000 purchase, you know, it's $1,000.
Yeah.
It's it's not nothing.
Right.
So 50% seems totally reasonable to me. And then I saw that, well, if their thing's a bestseller at $18, we got a lot of room to come in lower than them. And actually, like, so people criticize capitalism a lot. And sure, I would criticize, there's a lot of things that capitalism does wrong. But one thing it does really right is when someone is gouging and it's a free market kind of situation, then someone else will come in and fix that problem by coming in lower.
Right.
Eventually, price gouging gets fixed.
So you came in
that's it.
And helped drop the price.
Correct.
It's kind of cool that you've built this like side business to your like main business. Like I didn't even realize that you owned Voltage. And so when you stepped in, I was like, wow, that's amazing. That's brilliant. What even was the event? So like making those condition rings and then realizing you could sell dice totally better led you to Viridian Dice. But what about Voltage? Well, how'd you end up there?
How'd I end up doing? I mean, one second. Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's the anticipation here.
I'm good. I feel bad because you have water. I'm like,
oh, don't worry about it.
I feel like I should use that water.
No, it's all good.
But then it's like wasteful. Like, why would I drink water?
You brought your own. You came prepared, man.
Yeah. So my throat can kind of dry out. So I just bring water.
Oh, perfect.
Okay. So the question was how to get into Voltage, right? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Okay. So I've always loved video games, right? So I've played video games since I was like very little. I was playing like Wolfenstein 3D when I was like 4 on my dad's IBM computer.
Amazing.
I was waking up early at 6 a.m. to play like the first Mario or the third Mario. That was crazy. With my sister was there and like the sun like getting angry and coming down and like and killing me. So I've played video games my whole life. I've gotten really into like Nintendo hard video games. So I love like Dark Souls and a lot of like the really like games that punish you. And then when you beat them, you
Elden
have like
Ring,
a sense of like accomplishment. Yeah, Elden Ring's like easy mode, Dark Souls too.
Easy mode, dude.
Yeah, it's super easy.
Dang, dude, Mike, I can't believe you're saying that.
Oh, it's so easy.
I play video games, Mike, I want to relax and chill.
I've heard that.
I don't want to throw my controller through a wall. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know when I gave up on Dark Souls when the very first boss, spoiler alert, right off the gate, you're not supposed to fight. That's true.
Yeah.
You can
actually beat him.
I spent 2 hours trying to beat this guy.
Oh, you couldn't, though.
Until I realized.
Yeah, you have to be good. You have to be really good.
That's two hours of me just learning how to play and hit the buttons right in the beginning.
Well, so the thing about that is they are teaching you a lesson like really early. Some people refuse to get that lesson, but the lesson is like what you're doing is not working. You need to try other things.
Yeah.
That's the lesson they're trying. And also that they're trying to instill pretty early. Like not every boss you run into are you going to be prepared to actually fight. Right. So trying to give you a dual lesson of like, use your environment, like think creatively, like don't
fight him for 2 hours.
Yeah, don't do that. And also, you're not meant to just like, this isn't the kind of game where if we present you with something, you're supposed to do it.
Right.
It's not that kind of game. And unfortunately, I think you've been misserved by a lot of other games that you've played, which have taught you the opposite lesson.
Right.
So you as a gamer have been led to believe here are the rules for games. And so you never thought like, oh, maybe this game is different, or maybe like there are other things I could learn from this.
True.
So it's kind of unfortunate that you didn't give it more of a try.
I tried Elden Ring. I played about 12 hours of Elden Ring.
Okay. That's a good amount.
And it was good. I didn't spend
11 of those hours fighting the first guy.
Not the first guy, because I learned my lesson that I forget the...
There you go.
What is the creator?
Miyazaki?
Yeah, well, anyways.
Miyazaki, I think.
I
might have that wrong. If I have that wrong, I'm sorry.
I just avoid the big guy at first and just try to... But I also... you're right, though. It is easy mode in a sense where it was like laid out a little bit easier and to understand the gameplay a little bit more.
Elden Ring did a better job of introducing that first lesson, right?
Right.
By having a wide expanse. Also, I have the line I just said, like I have a lot of guys on my brain or something. Like, well, not like that.
That's all good.
So Elden Ring does a better job introducing that lesson because they give you a wide expanse when you first kind of enter the world.
Right.
So you can clearly see, I can go a bunch of different directions and you have to go out of your way to approach the knight that you see. Now, the first knight is like right there. So you probably will approach him because you can see him. But you also know that like I can go these
other ways.
Yeah. You have to like go direct, like beeline to him. And you have a lot of time to think that I'm approaching this knight. I wonder if I should be doing that. And then the knight absolutely crushes you. The guy in Dark Souls, you get a couple of hits in. So you feel like, oh, I just need to dodge those hits. This guy like one shot you. So you know like right away, like, oh, well, that guy clearly is like way, and he also looks way powerful.
Right.
Like, so you know, like this dude looks really strong.
Yeah.
So they've instilled the lesson a little better that like, I could have gone a different direction. I probably shouldn't be fighting him because he looks like a dude from like the end of the game.
Yeah, he looks like end boss game.
And they introduce other guys earlier in like the tutorial, which a lot of people missed, unfortunately. I don't think they did a great job with that. But in the tutorial, you fight like some ragged looking like skeleton dudes. Mm-hmm. So like you can tell the difference now. Not every dude is going to look like a fully beefed up
knight
with armor. So they took the same lesson, but they did it better in Elden Ring.
Yeah.
And that's why I'd say Elden Ring is more easy mode, because there's less like having, they instill the lessons better and also give you a lot of room to go different directions and just kind of level up if you don't feel like you're ready for them.
And get ready for a big boss. Yeah, for sure. Right. They definitely do a better job with
Dark
that too.
Souls, unless you're kind of just grinding areas, it's a little harder to do that.
Right, right. Yeah. So that led you into creating Voltage, your love for video games, your passion for Voltage.
Right.
We got a little off track.
We did.
Welcome to the show. That's what happens.
So, oh yeah, it's like my speaking style. Let's get sidetracked. I mean, I always loved video games, right? And my dad kind of instilled some like lessons about business into me early. And I was like, not sure what I wanted to do. I was out of college. I got a degree and then I got a master's. And I spent a little bit of time with the military and a little bit of time with a couple other jobs. And then I didn't know what I wanted to do. And one, I was working as a web designer, so I was kind of doing my own business thing. And it was working okay. I was paying my bills. And one of the people at the design company I was kind of doing some freelance work for mentioned that he worked at this video game store. Before that, I helped out with marketing and web design, and that was kind of where I was spending my time. I helped out a buddy's video game store out in Albany. He runs a place called Pastime Legends, still does it. Joe, great guy. And so I was helping him, but by helping him, I could kind of see behind the scenes on how like they did things.
How he ran things. Right?
And I didn't spend a lot of time watching them, but and I didn't need to because I realized very quickly, there's not a lot to this. It's pretty simple. Like you buy things at a rate, you sell them at a higher rate. Most people will just sell them to you. You look them up a little. You do a percentage. It's very straightforward. I've pretty much, there you go. I've told you everything you need to know to open a video game store. You should not do that, not just because it would be competing with me. So biased and self-interested, right? But because at this point, it's so late in the game on video games, they are reaching a point where they are more a collector's item. So they're just like, they don't make them like they used to. Mm-hmm. There's a reason not very many places sell video games anymore. The market for physical things has just diminished. Now, we're fine because we just take a larger percentage of a shrinking pond, right? Mm-hmm. Because like as the pond shrinks, people exit the market and then we take their percentage of the market. Right. So it's been fine, but I don't think it'd be a great idea to start one now.
Like, are that you like seems like going to idea. Like swap meets and like different garage sales to buy stuff, or is it usually people who come to you?
I did that. Yeah. I did that for 6 months before I opened the store because I just needed inventory. And back then, and I'm talking 2012, you could find a lot of stuff, right? I think you could also find a lot of stuff in 2008. You could also find a lot of stuff in 2000. But that market has certainly dried up.
Interesting.
Yeah, I would say around 2015, 2016, it really started to become difficult to find large amounts of retro video game stuff.
That's very interesting. Yeah,
something around there.
I wonder what, just because of the fact that physical media has shrank really since, I would say, 2015, 2016.
There are a few reasons for it, right? So reason one is stores like mine opened up and started absorbing a lot of that, right? Mm. Reason two would be the access to knowledge increased or improved. So like every pawn shop, every guy who wanted to make a quick buck could now Google things and know what they were worth. And they had access to things like Facebook Marketplace or eBay and stuff. So they were self-selling, or if some, you know, some grandma has like a tub of things, her kid might be able to look it up, or she could obviously do it, or she'd put it out on the garage sale and there'd be people picking right at like when she opened and they're like, I know these are valuable because I've looked them up. Yeah. So it just destroyed the ability for anyone to like go around and get a lot of it because
everybody's finding it now.
So everyone had the information. With everyone having the information,
right,
dried up the market. And then also just supply diminished over time, you know?
Right.
So, and also like newer games were holding less resale value because they were putting them on digital platforms.
Right.
They were releasing more garbage games. So like a lot of companies have really stopped focusing on quality and started focusing on gimmicks and putting out the same game every year, et cetera. Yeah. So.
Yes. That's been my gripe with Call of Duty games. I used to be big into Call of Duty when I was in high school, but just like, why we're playing the same game every year? That drives me crazy. But anyway, so you now created Voltage. Yep. When did you open that business?
So Voltage opened in summer of 2012. So we've been open, it's amazing to believe, like 12 years.
That's awesome.
Holy, can I swear?
Yeah.
Holy fuck.
Yeah.
It's a long respect. Amount of time.
What do you think attributes to the long time success?
Well, two big things, right? First is my mentality of the everyday value, right? So I've always been very focused on having the best prices, and not having a lot of gimmicks and a lot of garbage. So like, for instance, right, I won't name any names, but like a competitor of ours would go, hey, GameStop's got it at 50. Well, then we'll have it at 45. Ha ha, what a great deal. And a lot of people go in and be like, it is cheaper. What a great deal. And that works until a shop like mine opens up, goes, well, GameStop's got it at 50, but the internet's got it going for like Amazon, eBay, have it going for like $25.
All right.
So we'll price that. I mean, okay, we'll add a little bit of like a retailer fee, right? And we'll go 30, right? And most people will go, I'll pay an extra $5 to get it locally, have a warranty, pick it up today, et cetera. But we'll price that 30. And so suddenly that 45 looks really overpriced.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then sometimes we'll just price that 25. We'll be the same as the internet because, like, why should we be more? And the logic I've heard from shop owners, just in general, like I've heard from any number of video game store owners over the years, right, is that, like, well, you should pay a premium because we're a retail store. Like, we're doing you a service. It's like, okay. I mean, maybe that was true when it took 2 weeks to get to you for like, buying from Amazon or whatever.
Right.
But when it could be here overnight, tomorrow, or in 2 days, 3 days from eBay or whatever, why are we paying? Why is someone bothering to go out of their way to leave their house to come into your store to pay more? Yeah. I mean, I guess like getting it today is pretty nice, but you could get it tomorrow for half the price.
Tomorrow with Prime next day delivery.
Right, for half the price. Yep. Right, and the returns are easy, and they have a very compelling offer, especially when it's half the price. Now, if you're about the same price, well, then you can make the argument. Like, you can get today, you get a warranty, you support a local business. But if you're twice their price, it's hard to justify. People don't love retail that much. And in fact, a lot of people don't like retail at all.
Right.
And you're charging more. So right. It's like you're giving them a reason not to come.
Not to shop there, right. Right. So you just stay competitive on your prices and that's you really utilize like basically the internet of what things are going for.
Right. And right. The thing is like a lot of stores focus on like making as much money as they can on every sale. And that has never been my mentality and never been what I shoot for. There are sales that we straight up lose money on, like, right? Like, we obviously try to avoid that, or we don't make a lot of money on, right? And we just go, okay. And what we try to do is make it up on the next one, right? Because we are aiming toward, like, if the customer leaves happy and they think they got a great deal, well, then they'll come back.
Yeah, they'll come back and spend more money.
We're not focused on making the most on every sale. We're focused on long-term customers, long-term relationships, and we'll make it up in volume.
Right.
Because they'll come back to us, whereas when they find out, oh, that $40 game is sold $20 somewhere else, or I could have bought on eBay for $20 or whatever, well, then they'll go, oh, I'm never shopping there again.
Right.
Whereas that doesn't happen with our shop, I hope, where I think they go, oh, I got a good deal. I'm going to go back. And we reframe the reference price for a lot of people. It's an interesting thing. So when I was working or not working, helping out at, yeah, working, helping out, shopping at Pastime Legends in Albany, right? I would see their prices all day, or I'd see their prices pretty regularly, right? And I would go to another shop and I'd go, oh, that price is high. Well, what am I basing that being high on? The shop I'm familiar with.
The shop you first saw, right?
The shop I frequent, right?
Right.
If I go, oh, their price is high. Oh, that price is high too. That one's okay, but that one's high too. Well, then I'm going to know this place is high. I'm never coming back here, right? If the opposite happens though, let's say you shopped at some place that was higher than us. Let's say you shop at GameStop, right? And you go in there and all day long you see their prices and you know their prices and you come into ours and you go, oh, that game that's $40 from them is $20 here. These guys are really cheap. Right. Whoa. And then you're going to start shopping here. And eventually you start shopping at Voltage or start shopping at the cheaper place so often that now they're your reference point. All their prices are normal. And when you go somewhere else and they're high, you go, oh, this place is high and I'm never going back. So the point is to make sure people come back to us and then set their pricing based on how we have our pricing.
And how are you checking prices? Is this a daily thing?
Oh,
is this
God, like all the time.
Yeah.
It's very manual. I wish there was software. I mean, there is software that can do this kind of stuff, but it's not. So you have kind of a choice with software, right? In the video game, kind of in that industry, my industry, right? Option one is that you buy very niche video game specific, buy, sell, trade specific software made by a very small company. And it tries to do the video game stuff as good as it can do, right? And it's generally okay, right? Generally okay. It's made by a small team. They don't have a ton of software developers and stuff. So that's option one, right? Option two is that you go with a mass-made point-of-sale system that does the video game stuff really poorly. You have to do it manually.
Right.
But it does everything else really well because it's made for 10 million different businesses.
Right.
And it has a small team of developers that work on it constantly.
Right.
So, for instance, on that second one, you get really good receipts and you get really good labels and you get really good reports and things like that. But it does none of the video game stuff. And then the first one, you get like some okay video game stuff, but the reports suck and
everything
the labels
suck
and the receipts suck and it has no integrations and et cetera.
So
it's
there's
buggy.
A give and take.
So you have to choose which one you want. So we chose the latter. So we have a really good point of sale system,
yeah.
But it does none of the video game stuff for us.
Well, it's kind of, you gotta pick your battles, right? So like you at least keep up on the prices to make sure like you're the most competitive, even online.
We try.
You have to beat the internet, dude. That's hard.
And
that's
tough. It has gotten harder over time, not only because people are, they know more, so they're going to call you on every little thing, which is fine, and tell us like the price is bad. That's useful for us to know, and we'll drop the price on the spot sometimes, mm-hmm. which is something that like places don't do.
No one would ever do, right?
But we'll go like, hey, this actually, you're right. It is cheaper. I'll drop it $5 for you.
Yep.
And they're like, cool. And they're very happy. Or sometimes we learn like, actually it's gone up quite a bit. If you don't want to buy it, I'll sell it to you for this price. But if you don't buy it when you leave, we're going to raise the price. So like, it's actually a great deal and you should
buy it. Well, you kind of have to. I'd imagine, especially in the collectible space, you're saying video games are becoming more collectible.
Yeah.
The price in collectibles never seem to be like steadily always upwards. Sometimes there's like peaks and values.
Yeah.
So it's like trying to keep up with all of that and all the different titles has got to be so hard.
Well, and I was saying that it's become harder, not only because of that information, but also because there's just more stuff. When I opened my store, there was no PlayStation 4. There was no Xbox One. There was no Xbox Series. There was no PlayStation 5. There was no Nintendo Switch. There was 3DS was pretty new, right? So
3DS was new.
Ish, yeah. So there was all these things. There's all these things now. So I just trained like a new general manager, right? And he's doing great. Sean, nice job. You're doing it.
Good job, Sean.
Yeah. So it occurred to me like, oh my God, he has to learn so many more things than I had to learn coming into this, just because there's twice as many systems now. There's twice as many games. There's twice as many pieces. Like dealing with HDMI was a pretty small issue in 2012. Like most TVs had composite inputs, which are like those red, yellow, white, and whatever. Now, not only do you have to deal with HDMI, and you still have to deal with some of that old analog stuff, and they don't always talk, because usually when you buy a TV now, it doesn't have those composite inputs. So you got to get an adapter. Oh, and by the way, also 4K operates differently than 1080p. So like our TV, for instance, when you're hooking it up to a PS5, you have to like reset the video settings because it literally doesn't understand this input that's 4K, because when that TV was made in 2011, that was not a thing. So it's like, it's gotten more complex and more difficult over time versus like, you know, if you had opened a video game and rental place, right, in 1990, you'd have Nintendo games, maybe Super Nintendo games were just hitting the market, and what, VHS?
Right.
And that was like it.
Right.
And your whole shop had three different formats or four different formats, whatever it was. Today, like, we have 10 different formats more.
Yeah, that's a good point. I never thought
like
of that.
Plus handhelds. Like, it's gotten much more complex.
Yeah. Now, do you guys only, like, specialize in video games? I think you guys sell, like, D&D books, too, if I'm wrong correctly.
We have a few, and we have board games and stuff. We don't do great on them.
But you just focus mostly on...
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have some accessories and some stuff, but, like, it's mostly video games. Yeah. That's where we have done best. We used to sell movies. And it's kind of funny. So Soundgarden downtown, like, they used to sell video games, and we just destroyed them on video game pricing. They would end up telling people to come to us if they didn't have stuff. And they just, like, gave it up at some point. They were just like, oh, just go to Voltage. Just, we don't want to do it anymore. It's like we've lost money on some stuff. It's not our specialty, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And the opposite happened for us in, like, movies, right? So, like, Soundgarden would offer more for movies, and we just like sold them all for a bulk price, and we didn't care about the pricing, and they individually priced them. And so eventually we're just like, ah, we don't want to do movies anymore. Go to Soundgarden. Just go to Soundgarden. Right. So we're doing that, right? And now I don't even think they do movies, but like, why did I get in that? Oh, right. Yeah. Cause we mostly just do video games.
At this point. Mostly do video games.
That's what. And also going back to the question you had earlier, which was like, why have you been successful? Why have you been able to do it? Right. The other big, so one part of it's
the price. It's a long time to be open, man. 12 years. Yeah. Crazy. Yeah.
It must have worked, right?
Yeah.
So the one thing is the pricing and making sure we're staying reasonable, right? Being reasonable to customers, right? And the other part is like customer service. It's just decent customer service. I don't say we have great customer service. I say we have okay customer service, but everyone else has poor customer service. We look great in comparison, but we're doing nothing special, right? Nothing special. We'll often look at what other businesses do as examples of what not to do.
Right.
So I will show people especially small businesses love to respond to negative reviews with like vitriol.
Oh, attacking back, right?
Yeah. And like, I get it. There certainly are times when the customer is absolutely wrong and at fault. And like, you should defend yourself to a degree, but you should also remember that that response isn't really for the guy that's like absolutely livid, right? Because like that person's already decided, like you suck and they will not come back.
Right.
It's really to show everyone else that that person is unreasonable and you are very reasonable and like make yourself look as good as you can in that situation. Mm-hmm. So you have an audience, which is everybody else. And I get that the instinct is like, if we defend ourselves really well, then we'll prove that they're wrong and we're right. When in most times, like, you're just better to be like, hey, you may have a point there. I'm sorry there was a miscommunication. We'll try to do better, right? And most people look at that and they're like, oh, well, then they seem reasonable.
Right.
Even though, like, we're not defending, you're not really defending yourself that much.
Right.
But yeah, that's and then also it comes with this, the response to those reviews, right? Reminds me of this attitude I see with video game store owners, and I'm sure it's with owners in general, with people in general, right? That the customer is out to get us, and I have to protect my business from those customers that are trying to get me.
Oh, it's funny. I don't even see that perspective as a consumer. I don't even see that perspective.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I see it a lot, right? And it also has to do with employees too, right? So like I see video game store owners who are like, my employee made a bad purchase decision and cost me $50. I'm going to take it out of their paycheck. I can't believe it. How do I keep my employees from making this mistake? What do you guys do? Like on these groups of video game store owners, right? They're like, what do you guys do to keep my employees from screwing me?
Yeah.
And then like, and keep my customers from screwing me. And I have a customer that comes in and always finds the things that are priced wrong and gets me on them. It's this vibe of everyone's out to get me. How do I keep all my money? And it's like,
those groups are so always the toxic people are always the most loud.
It's the like loudest. Everyone. It's like crazy. It's so many people. And in they all groups. Have stores. Yeah. And like a lot of their stores go out of business. And it's like, I wonder why. If you treat the customer like they're your enemy and like they're out to get you, like, yeah, that's gonna permeate like every aspect of your business. Same with employees. Like, you know what? Employees screw up. Usually what I say is like, okay, it's a learning experience. Like, you screwed up, you should learn lessons from it. It isn't great, depending on how bad it is, right? But like, what lessons do you learn is what I ask, and let them tell you the lessons that they learned. And right. It's like, if the lessons aren't the right ones, and you go like, okay, well, let's actually learn the right lessons here, and like, blah, blah, blah. But like,
that's called being a good business owner and a good boss.
Yes. Yeah, because nobody's going to do it perfect. Maybe you, the owner, would do it perfect every time, which I doubt, right. By the way.
Yeah, that's some bullshit. That's what I'm calling bullshit on that.
Yeah.
You're going to mess up every once in a while.
Or maybe your most experienced employees can like do it best. But like, you get experienced employees because they've made those mistakes. Mm-hmm. They've done it, right?
Right?
And if you have someone who really isn't competent, well, then you let them go. But like, most people are going to make mistakes. and it's learning experiences. And if their recollection is, I made a mistake and then the boss like yelled at me and took it out of my pay, they're not going to want to work hard for the business or care about you. Whereas if their recollection is like, hey, I screwed up, but it was okay. And my boss just wants me to learn a lesson from, like to learn the right lessons from it. But he was cool about it. Otherwise, they're going to go, that was nice. Like, he didn't yell at me. My Burger King boss screamed at me in front of everybody.
Yeah,
this guy didn't.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm going to keep working here.
Yeah.
This guy's good. Just I'm going to try to do a good job for him so I can keep my job.
Showing some empathy, you know, showing some kindness goes a long way, especially with management.
Oh, my God.
A little kindness and empathy, especially in ownership and...
The funny thing, so have you heard of the Peter Principle?
No, what is that?
Okay, so the Peter Principle is basically the idea that people rise to their level of their own incompetence, right? So they do a good job at whatever they're doing, and they get promoted. And they keep getting promoted until they reach the job that they're no longer really qualified for and don't have the training for, et cetera. And people don't fire them typically, so they just kind of sit there being kind of incompetent at this job when below maybe they were doing great. So teachers have this happen a lot where you're a great teacher. So they're like, we'll make you the administrator for the whole department. It's like, but they're not a good administrator. They're a good teacher.
They're a good teacher. Right.
So they don't know how to be an administrator. And then they end up being kind of an incompetent dummy who sits around and doesn't get fired because they're in a union and like you don't just don't typically fire someone for being kind of subpar.
Right.
Not in those kind of jobs anyway. So it's the Peter Principle. So a lot of these guys who open these shops, right? They don't know how to manage people. They maybe knew how to do like swap meet stuff and then they opened a store.
They're good at that aspect.
And there aren't a lot of video game stores, so they didn't have most of them don't tend to have a lot of competition, right?
Right.
So yeah, they don't know how to manage people, and they also don't have the competition to keep them honest, which is like that thing I was talking about earlier, where in capitalism, you know, you have competition, you end up with good prices because like people compete, and obviously it doesn't work when you have like drug manufacturers who have no competitors or whatever, right. Or who change the laws. Or
three companies who own 80% of the branding.
Exactly, right. But. It should work to create good both customer service and pricing as the people who aren't good at it get kind of knocked off, right?
When you look at your entire time as being the owner of a Voltage and running that business, what's like your proudest moment as a business owner? Is there like one moment that sticks out?
Proudest moment as a business owner. I have one in mind. Let me think if I can come up with anything that might be better, though. Laptop's loud. I got a MacBook, and I swear, like, I didn't want to get a MacBook. Yeah. I hate Apple, but their MacBooks are good, and they're quiet.
Yeah, my that's a Razer I got, which is it's nice, but it's got the power I need to like do the editing for the videos and stuff.
Yeah, I like maxed out. One of these MacBook Pros. I got it like used, so yeah. Like it gave me a little more flexibility on price.
Yeah,
it gets ridiculous, but I like maxed it out. Then I found that like, I'm only using like 20% of the resources. So I really probably didn't need to go this overboard.
Yeah.
So I think
proudest moment.
Yeah. Done stalling. I think the proudest moment was probably my dad, right? So he said he didn't really understand what my business was about, but he hoped I would be successful, et cetera. And I remember telling him like, hey, I had a record day. We did X number of dollars. I'm misremembering, right? So he had said something to the effect of like, well, let's see when you crack like $500, right? And this was 2012, so $500 was a little more money back then, right? So it's yeah, maybe double, maybe it'd be $1,000 today, right? So I don't know if that's right. But like he said, hey, when you crack 500, that'll be a cool day. And then like, because I said I was doing pretty well, I must have been doing less than 500. So maybe I was doing like $300 a day or something like that. And then I hit 500 and I called him and I said, like, I cracked 500. I did like $700 or whatever I did. And he's like, wow, maybe you got something here.
Yeah.
That felt pretty great. And then that was, I think it was on like a Friday, right? And then like the Saturday, I cracked 500 again, but I did like, I think I maybe have doubled it. I maybe did $1,000, right? And then so I called him back and I'm like, hey, you know that day I did like 500?
Well, yeah, that was yesterday, son.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know if he said that, but that would have been really funny. He probably said, yeah. I said, well, I did 1,000 today. And he's like, wow. Yeah, it seems like you got a good business here. I don't understand it, but like the numbers don't lie. And I think in that moment I was like, yeah, fuck yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're like, yeah, I got something here.
Yeah, I got something.
And you got dad's high five and stamp of approval too.
He ran a lot of businesses.
He wasn't a video game dude. He had no idea what's up with these video games.
He started a family, right? And so I think his businesses were always about like supporting the family, right? Whereas I don't really have a family. And so for me, I was just like, let me just do things I'm passionate about and like see if I can make money on the things I like to do. So I did web design first, which I was passionate about. And then I did video games. And then I ended up doing, I wasn't passionate about the 3D printing, which is partially why we don't do 3D printing anymore. But I do love D&D, and so designing stuff for D&D, and I love design, so like designing stuff for D&D is pretty up my alley.
Look at that. We brought it full circle now. Okay. That's a nice full circle moment right there. One last question. What is the future?
We're done. Yeah. Oh, my God. Right? It went pretty fast. I don't know how long it's been.
A whole hour went by. Pretty cool, right? So what is next for Voltage? What's next for Viridian Dice?
So... for Voltage, right, we have a new general manager, and he is he wants to own the business at some point, so we're talking about that, right? And that'll be cool, and that'll be less on my plate if I can make that work, right? And then for and I'll still be involved, so if anyone's like, well, I want Mike Salzman to be involved, like, you may not have seen them, but I'm in this ad that's like really popular for Voltage. It's got like 1 million views on YouTube. So it's pretty popular. I get recognized from it.
Wow.
And so I'm sure people would joke a lot. Like, I never see the guy from the commercials here. So when I am in there, they're like, oh my God, it's the guy from the commercials.
That's funny.
So I'll still be involved, but like I want to stay, like, design seems to be where I'm like happiest and most fulfilled.
Like designing dice.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just things in general. Like I feel very fulfilled. So the things that fulfill me, right, there are two, right? Number one is when someone is like, hey, your store? I love your store. Thanks, man. And I'm like, yeah. I'm glad I brought something that someone else gets to love and enjoy, like creating things, right? And the other part of that is actually designing things that people are like, oh, I love your designs. Yeah. Well, I've had people approach me for dice now that are like, hey, I really want you to do your art on our die because I like your style. I like what you do. And that also lets me, like, so creating things is really fulfilling for me. And I think design is very up my alley because I get to work on my own schedule, on my own time, behind a computer. I don't love being like at the store, like for instance, and like dealing with people face to face because I can be grouchy and mean and like not want to deal with people. And I like to sleep and things like
that. But that's your strength. Your strength is designing, and that's where you're.
I think so. Yeah. Like designing Voltage was my thing and like training people for that management. And now designing the dice is where I feel more fulfilled right now. Yeah.
Dude, well, this was awesome. Thank you so much. I appreciate you doing this.
Thank you.
Anything else you want to plug?
Ooh, anything else I want to plug? I mean,
go check out Voltage. Go check out ViridianDice.com.
Please. I appreciate it. It pays my bills and also for wet food for our cat Tux.
Pay the man some money for the cat, please.
He needs his wet food.
So what we'll do is we'll put all the website for Voltage, we'll put the website for Viridian Dice in the show notes below.
If you are in Syracuse and like video games, Voltage. If you like dice and you're anywhere, because we ship, Viridian Dice. I should ask you stuff about... Yeah, no, we don't have time. Sorry, we don't have time. Thanks, everybody.
There'll be a part two sometimes.
Where we reverse it and we interview Corey. Exactly. But no time this time. Have a great one, everyone. Nice to see you.